Science and religion. There seems to be an eternal war waged between them. The most bitter enemies of religion today are atheists, and atheists speak in the name of science. They brandish scientific ideas and scientific thinking, and they say that it has made religion outdated. And although this is a real conflict, and clearly I'm not on the atheist side, I do think that not only can we gain a great deal from science as religious people and as people looking at the world through a religious lens, but even we can take the element of atheism, of skepticism, the kind of disbelief, the basic kind of disbelief that atheists and scientists view the world through, and we can use that as a way to purify our faith. Atheism and skepticism can be used as a means of refining faith, turning it into something finer, higher, better. And we're going to explore all this through a very beautiful parable that appears in the book of the Zohar, the most basic Kabbalistic tract. The Zohar is a beautiful parable that can really help us. The Zohar says that before the world was created, God's wisdom was infinite, and it included all of the future knowledge of all mankind. Every possible kind of knowledge, every possible kind of truth was all together as this one sort of repository of all knowledge and all wisdom and all truth. And the Zohar likens this repository of wisdom to the waters of creation as they were in the first day of creation. So if you remember the story of creation, then on the first day, it just says that there was water. And it says the Spirit of God hovered over the waters, the surface. And only on the second day are those waters split into the waters above the firmament and the waters below the firmament. But on the first day, it's just one. There's one wisdom, and the Spirit of God is hovering over everything. Now, on the second day, what happens when the waters are split? Same goes for this divine wisdom. The divine wisdom is split into two kinds of wisdom, each one flowing from a different direction. One half, one part of divine wisdom flows from above to below. It rains down. How does it rain down? It rains down in the form of prophecy, inspiration, spiritual intuition that people have. We can say that the entire Bible came from this kind of flow of divine wisdom into the world. The Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, are one degree of prophecy, Moses' prophecy, and then the rest of the prophets is another degree of prophecy. And then, of course, every moment, every intuition, every burst of divine inspiration that anyone has experienced all over the world is coming from this kind of top-down, waters above the firmament kind of wisdom, which is basically spiritual wisdom or religious wisdom. Now, what about the waters below the firmament? So the waters below the firmament are springing up from, so to speak, springs in the earth, and that basically symbolizes science. Science is the effort through which humankind, without evident, overt divine inspiration, is looking at the world, exploring, researching, analyzing the world, thinking about it, developing the scientific method, and gradually discovering the laws of nature that are hidden within nature. And all this is the lower waters that are surfacing gradually to the face of the earth, which is basically the face of our knowledge. And so just looking at this image is beautiful, because really what it says is that at their root, science and religion, not only are they not enemies, but they're almost like long-lost siblings. They are like brothers who were separated at birth, or sisters. And they appear in totally different ways, totally different directions. One is raining down, the other one is sort of bursting up. But really, their source is one, and they used to be, in the first day of creation, they used to be just one big reservoir of water. So this really means is that if we are able to reunite them, to integrate them, to integrate the religious, spiritual, mystical knowledge with the empirical, scientific, materialistic knowledge, we are really recovering, rediscovering the original unity, the original one repository of divine wisdom. And this is really the fulfillment of the verse, famous verse in Isaiah, that says that one day the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of God as the water covers the sea. It'll be like a kind of spiritual positive flood, just like in the flood in Noah's time. The waters came both from the fountains of the deep and from the windows of the heavens. So too, this spiritual flood will involve both mystical knowledge, spiritual religious knowledge, and scientific empirical knowledge. And coming together, they will recreate the original divine wisdom. Now, all this sounds very nice, but as we know, most atheist scientists don't really want this kind of unification. They want science to be purely rational and empirical and naturalistic. They don't want any faith. They don't want any mysticism. They don't want any spirituality. But there is a beautiful, beautiful story in the Jewish tradition that really goes along with this parable from the Zohar that suggests that there is a difference, a gap between what science declares or projects on the outside and the sort of the inner emotion that is under the surface over there. So this exegetical story says that when the waters were separated in the second day of creation, then there was a difference between the waters above the firmament and the waters below. Those above were, right, they are clouds, so they're very airy, they're very spiritual, so to speak. They're a metaphor for spirituality. They're up in the skies, and they're closer to God, so to speak. Whereas those at the bottom became coarser and more physical, and they were more distant from God. And so the parable says that they started crying. The lower waters, they started crying. And they missed, because they had longing. They wanted to reunite with God. And they became very bitter. And because they became bitter, they started rebelling. In Hebrew, the word for bitterness, bitter, mar, and the word for rebellion, meri, are almost identical. It's the same letter, same root. And the word, so they started rebelling out of bitterness. And in their anger, in their frustration, they threatened to drown the world with a kind of huge tsunami. Now God stopped them and put them in their place. But on the other hand, he could tell that this rebellion, this kind of desire to drown the world, it didn't come out of some evil desire, or they weren't really bad at heart. It came out of their frustration, out of their sadness, out of their longing to be reunited with him. So he said, I forgive you, and now you have a border. You can't cross this border. That's the coastline, all the coastlines in the world. But I will give you reparations. And then he decided to incorporate water that's taken, not rainwater, water that's taken from the sea or from rivers, and he incorporated it into the service of the temple. So what does this tell us about science? It tells us that science is, on the surface, a bitter enemy of religion. And it comes to wash away faith and religion and, so to speak, drown nature in a kind of worldview in which there's only physical reality. There's only matter, there's only energy, there's only the laws of physics, and that's it. There's no room for hope or faith in anything transcendent, anything beyond nature. And this is beautiful. Another beautiful allusion in Hebrew. The Hebrew word for nature, teva, is the same root of the word to drown. So saying that everything is nature, there's nothing outside naturalistic processes, is like drowning us in a kind of materialistic worldview. And that's what the lower waters wanted to do on the surface. But as this story tells us, this cynicism was really an expression of sadness, of a feeling of loneliness, a feeling of being orphaned, being far away from this divine source of the world and wanting to reunite with this source, with spirituality, with the meaning, with the divine root of everything in the world. And if you look under this, the cynical veneer, the cynical exterior of atheists and the way they talk and the way they make fun of religion, you can see that inside, it's really a kind of, they're trying to say, on the inside, they're saying, I really wish someone could go past my stormy exterior, my bitter exterior, and convince me that I'm wrong, convince me that there is something beyond physicality, beyond the physical laws of nature. And another Hebrew remark is that the word for science in Hebrew, mada, is made up of the same letters as the word for tear. There's something about, just like the lower waters were weeping, and that's why they're salty, they were weeping, then science in its heart is sort of weeping or longing. I wish someone strong enough, wise enough would come and show me that there is a way to contain and include everything that I've discovered about nature and still convince me that there is something beyond nature, that there is God. This is like this, the idea that's hidden in this story. Now, so this, a lot of things come out of this idea. So the first thing is that when we're talking about waters that cry and then they become salty, then as we know, seawater is undrinkable. Seawater is too much salty. It's full of too much salt. There are only a precious few places with fresh water. So what does it mean that science is a kind of mixture of good, healthy, pure waters and bitter, poisonous salts? It basically means that what we know today as science is also a mixture of true knowledge that science has acquired about nature through the scientific method. And this is pure, fresh, beautiful water that we can and should adopt and agree with and say that we want this and embrace this. But there's also the bitter salts. What are the bitter salts? They're all kinds of basically dogmatic assumptions and principles that were added to the real scientific knowledge, and this makes turns science from a very good endeavor to understand nature into a kind of worldview that is not fully founded, and it's something that negates faith and is in a way dogmatic. There's a famous scientist called Rupert Sheldrake. He wrote a whole book about this called, that the subtitle was The 10 Dogmas of Science. It was, it had two titles. I think in England it was called The Science Delusion, and in America it was called Science Set Free. But it's the same book, and he exposes these kind of dogmatic assumptions that not science itself, but what is called scientism, which is science as an ideology, science as a worldview, has adopted. And they should all be scientifically put to the test, and alternatives should be explored, which is what this scientist guy, very fascinating guy, you should all hear him and read him, Rupert Sheldrake, is saying. So now this kind of logical mistake or leap that goes from science to scientism is really everywhere. Basically what it says is that since we've been able to explain much of the natural phenomena using the laws of physics, that means that all natural phenomena could be explained using the laws of physics. So this is a big jump. The fact that you can explain much of something doesn't mean you can explain all of it. Same goes for explaining the various phenomena of life using evolution. We have been able to explain a great deal of biological properties that organisms have and the way they survive, the way they operate in nature, using evolutionary explanations. It doesn't mean that we can now determine, without a doubt, that all life, all the life itself, and the genetic information that goes into the genetic material, and everything about life could be explained using evolution. It's just a big, big jump that doesn't make sense. And the third example is, since we've been able to identify that physical occurrences in the brain create certain mental states and mental feelings, then again, the jump is made that the soul, the mind, the psyche, consciousness is fully reducible to brain activities. This is, again, a big, big jump. Obviously, the correlation, brain states influence mind states. The other way around is also true. Mental states influence brain states. But it doesn't mean at all that the consciousness is a product of the brain. It doesn't mean that. It means that there's a correlation, they somehow work together. But there's still something deeply, inherently different. One is an objective physical object. The other is the subjective experience, a subjective feeling of having consciousness. So the meaning of this is that every time you hear that science knows something or that science proved something, you need to be careful. Science knows much, but it doesn't know everything. It explains a great deal. It doesn't explain everything. Science should be put in the right context. It's a tool for refining and refuting theories about the physical world. It isn't a prophetic instrument that gives us a glimpse into metaphysics. Science is about physics, not metaphysics. It can't explain metaphysical truths, which sometimes many atheists presume that it does. So basically what we need to do, now that we realize that science is a kind of, like seawater, it's a mixture of good water with salt, then we need to do something that Israelis are very good at, which is desalination. Israel, the state of Israel, became like a powerhouse of desalination. It has the most advanced facilities to desalinate seawater, and people from all over the world are coming to Israel to learn this. But just as Jews have become experts in physical desalination, we need also to become experts in spiritual desalination. Spiritual desalination is taking each and every scientific idea and taking what's true and real about it, but desalinating it, taking away the dogmatic assumptions that presume or make this jump and reject or purport to refute any kind of supposition or idea that there is something spiritual beyond nature. But the story is even more interesting than that. So remember, in the beginning, I said that the lower waters were incorporated. God promised the lower waters because they were so distressed. He promised them that they would be incorporated into the service at the temple. But I didn't say exactly how. So there are two things over there. One of them we want to focus on. One of them is that God said that I'm going to use salt in the service of the sacrifices. When the sacrifices were brought in the tabernacle and then in the temples, then each sacrifice had to have salt in it as well. And the verse in this week's Torah portion of Vayikra, it says, "And you shall salt every one of your meal offering sacrifices with salt, and you shall not omit the salt of your God's covenant from being placed upon your meal offerings. You shall offer salt on all of your sacrifices." So the word salt actually appears four times in this verse. And now, according to the sages, and Rashi, the most important commentator, also brings this when he interprets this verse, the expression, "the salt of your God's covenant," alludes to this promise. This covenant is the promise that God made the lower waters, that their salt shall be incorporated into the surface of the temple. But hang on, didn't we just say that the salt was the negative element of science, the dogmatic assumptions that are inherently anti-religious? So how can we say that this element of the lower waters should be incorporated into the surface of the temple? So it's not exact. It's all a question of how much and in what context. Too much of this kind of atheistic salt does defile the waters. But there's an expression in English, you all know it, it's called take it with a grain of salt. When you say take it with a grain of salt, we mean with a healthy dose of skepticism. But the term is a grain of salt. This idea symbolizes that we can, if there's too much salt, again, we need to desalinate the whole thing. But if we're able to sort of isolate some grains of salt and take this energy of skepticism and of disbelief, and we sort of turn it into a grain of salt, this becomes healthy skepticism. And used correctly, this kind of salt, this kind of skepticism, can actually work in the service of faith. How can it serve faith? By purifying the worldview of religion from superstition. This kind of skepticism can be used to refine religious faith so that it becomes deeper, more refined, more internal, that it understands the inner meaning of things rather than taking them always literally. So let's put it this way. When we allow science to create our entire worldview, then we get a very, very materialistic, creatorless, soulless, spiritless world. On the other hand, if we don't use science at all, if we don't respect this kind of salty water, then we're back in a world full of superstitions, from very crude beliefs in all kinds of ghosts and goblins and spirits and the demons that we can believe that they're everywhere, through wrong, false theories about the way the world is built, the way matter is built, the way the world behaves. And it could also lead to a kind of blind faith in any kind of, let's say, alternative medicine. If it comes in, you know, beautiful words and it sounds mystical, it sounds spiritual, and we can go astray and believe just anything. But we're not supposed to believe anything. Why? Because experience has taught us that much of these beliefs are false. They may have a grain of truth in them, but they're really false. And how can we tell which of these beliefs are real and which are superstition? So the answer is scientific skepticism. If you hear an idea, it's mystical, it's spiritual, it sounds great. So great, it's great that it sounds great. But now we have to see if it's also true, if it's also correct. And we need skepticism and the scientific method to do that. And bear in mind, it's not black or white. An idea could be somewhat true, but not fully true. It could be true in a sense, in a spiritual sense, but not necessarily true on a physical, literal level. And also, it could be true in a certain context, but not in every context. So again, in order to tell the difference, we need to take things with a grain of salt using science. There was a very famous Jewish scientist called Carl Sagan. And Carl Sagan wrote a book that he called The Demon Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. What is the demon haunted world? The demon haunted world is our world, and it's haunted by demons, which are really superstitions. All kinds of things that sound real, that many people believe, but they're not really real. And then the candle that can dispel the darkness and can chase away the demons is, of course, science. Science can tell you if a theory is, holds water or it doesn't hold water. And it's very interesting that the term that Sagan used, demon, is very closely related to a Hebrew word, which is demion. Demion is imagination, something you imagine that's not true, like a demon. So this really go, and another thing is that this, the root of these two words, right, dimyon and or demon, demon, is just the two letters dalit and mem, like D and M. So that's also a word in Hebrew. It's dam. Dam is blood. So there's a deep connection in Hebrew between blood and imagination. In many ways, we can say that images and imagination is the kind of the blood of the soul, in the sense that it's the it's what circulates in the brain, and then it holds up more abstract and higher thoughts. But at first, a child just sees images and thinks in images, and it reads, you know, just stories. And then you can grow from stories to deeper stories to abstract philosophical thinking, but it starts with images. Images are like the blood. So if we said, so I'm going with Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan calls science a candle in the dark. We can also liken science to salt. And what does salt do? Salt, it extracts, it pulls in the blood of the meat. That's why it's supposed to be with sacrifices, because if you put the salt, it sort of drinks in or pulls in the blood. So we can say that scientific skepticism is just like salt, but it doesn't pull in the blood, it pulls in the imaginations, the imaginary entities and theories that we have in our head, and they just get soaked into this kind of skeptical idea. And we can even add something else. How do you say superstition in Hebrew? Superstition in Hebrew is emunat fila, which really literally means insipid belief, tasteless belief. So the idea is, what does salt do? Salt takes something that's insipid, that doesn't have flavor, doesn't have taste, and makes it tasty. So just like we just said, that science, that salt can take away the blood, the imagination of superstition, it can also take superstition, which is an insipid belief, and turn it into a belief that has flavor. Flavor is also meaning. So the upshot of all this video is that when we read the verse that you shall not omit the salt of your God's covenant from your meal offerings, then we should say your meal offerings are basically the sacrifices you make, or the service of God. We serve God today. Instead of sacrifices, we pray. It's the same idea. It's how we serve God. So take your faith and hold on to your faith, but add a grain of salt, a grain of skeptic salt, to your faith, and it'll become much better, more refined. You'll take away the blood of imaginary superstition, and you'll take away the insipidness, and you'll turn it into something that has more flavor, has more meaning, is deeper, is more refined. So I hope you enjoyed this class. If you like this class, please leave a comment below. I'd love to hear what you think. Like the video, share the video, subscribe to the channel, and I'll see you all in the next video. This video was made possible through the kind support of my sponsors over at Patreon. Patreon is a great way to help independent creators like myself produce original content. If you'd like to get more English language videos from me, please consider becoming a supporter via Patreon. You can find the link in the description below. Thank you very much.